Hey, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and for today's episode, I am joined by Ian Kimmett, who is the singer, songwriter, and second guitar player from a hard rock, glam rock band active in the early 70s in the UK called Juke. And Juke was made up of Ian, guitar player Trevor White, bassist Ian Hampton, and drummer Chris Townsend. And they were managed by John Hewlett, who at the time was managing Sparks. And John Hewlett had been a member of John's Children. Drummer Chris Townsend was also a member of that band. And another former member of John's Children, active in the glam rock scene at the time, was Mark Bolan, of course. So Juke released 5 singles between 72 and 74 while they were an active band, all with RCA, and only released in the UK. And then after the band split up, there was another 4-song EP that was released by Chiswick Records in the UK, and that came out in the US, released by Bomp Records. Also, in 2005, a 22-song CD called Different Class was released by RPM Records, which was distributed by Cherry Red Records, and that's a great compilation that includes pretty much everything, probably everything that Juke ever recorded. And you also get the 2 songs from Trevor White, the guitar player, put out a single after Juke split up. You get those songs, and you get a couple of demos from Ian Kimmett. So Different Class is a very comprehensive compilation CD of Juke material. Of course, it was released in 2005, and I'm pretty sure it's out of print. I'm not sure how difficult it is to get your hands on, but it's a great CD. This was a great band, and this should be a fun episode. So let's get to it. This is the conversation I had about the history of the band Juke with the band's frontman and main songwriter, Ian Kimmett.
Managing Gallagher and Lyle, and he was using my office. He allowed him to come in, and he shared my office, and we just bonded. And we were talking about how boring the whole music scene had become, you know. So I got together with Trevor, and we started playing, and we decided, hey, you know, we need some really fresh working class rock and roll. And so I left my job, he left his. We moved to Scotland to farmhouse. I was in the farmhouse. He was in a house in the town of Jedburgh, and we put the band together. But the whole point of it was we were really bored, you know, and with the music scene. And as soon as we got rolling and rocking and rolling, the whole glam thing took off, you know. And unfortunately, it was Mark Bolan had been in a band with John Hewlett, the manager, and Trevor had played occasionally, and John's Children. And suddenly the whole glam thing set off, you know, and all these people on TV painted up and, you know, androgynous people. And it was really weird because we were just a rock and roll band. So they decided we had to be part of the glam scene, you know, and RCA kept pushing us for a single, you know, like we were putting out all those records, and they said, just give us something we can get on Top of the Pops, you know, that's what we need. And so I sat down and composed This Bash Boss, you know, which was basically a Chin Chapman kind of strategy, and they loved it, of course. Yeah, this is what we needed, you know? And so then they had us audition for MAM, the big agent at the time, who were putting on a Sweet tour, and we passed it, and they said, yeah, you're going to support Sweet on a national tour, and Bish Bash Boss will work that, and we'll probably get you on Top of the Pops. And we were like, okay. The band were unhappy, you know. Trevor and everybody were like, oh, God, you know, Bish Bash Boss. It was a real commercial attempt, you know. I gotta get a job, you know. What we're gonna do? We couldn't get any bookings in the clubs or the universities. They were closing for the summer. The clubs were all booked. We were really high and dry. So I got a job. So Ian and Trevor were approached by Ron and Russell Mayall, who John was managing at that time, at Sparks, and they said, "Would the guys join us? Because we're gonna let the guitar player and the bass player go." And so they called me and they said, "What do you think? We should take the job." And I said, "Do it, just do it." You know, so they joined Sparks, and that was the end of the band. You know, Chris went back to playing, the drummer went back to playing in blues bands, and I got a job. And that was in 1974, the year you were born.
Right.
We had one last gig in Hartford, Connecticut. We got a call from Max Morton, a promoter of a 3-day heavy metal event in at a Webster in Hartford, Connecticut. And he said that there was a lot of Juke fans in Hartford. They'd love to see the band play. And I asked the guys, and they said, "Let's do it." You know, so it was a 40-year reunion, you know. So they came over. I went over there, and then they came over here, and then we did the gig. And my son filmed the whole thing, and he's just put it out as a little documentary, Juke's on You. And it won first place in the California Video Awards, as best live performance. So it's out now, you know, and so I should bring your attention to that, I guess.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. So I guess you answered some of my biggest questions. I was wondering where you fit into the glam scene, and, you know, if that was the kind of band you intended to be, and or if you were writing those songs, you know, to fit.
We were really rock and roll band, you know. We happened to dress like the Bay City Rollers, you know, at the time. We got our hair all, you know, spiked up and trimmed up, and we just happened to choose the clothes that the Bay City Rollers adopted. You know, they came to our gigs. They were Scottish too, and Tam Payton, their manager, we'd known from Edinburgh. And the next thing we knew, we were actually in Cornwall, I think, doing a gig, and we were sitting around watching the TV before the gig, watching Top of the Pops. And there we were, on top of the Pops, you know. Shit, we're on top of the Pops. And it was the Bay City Rollers, you know. And they had little tartan additives to the clothes, you know. So then we were like, whoa. So we changed our whole image to rugby shirts and boxing boots and everything else and realigned ourselves, you know. But, yeah, they lifted the whole image. So, and it was just natural for us, but they adopted it. So, yeah, and that was part of the glam thing. They were all glam bands, you know, and we were not trying to be a glam band, you know, but everybody, because it was the same time, and we were, you know, we were a good-looking young band, and we got on the front of all the girl magazines, you know, in the UK, you know, we did photo sessions and got into these magazines with all the glam people, well, like Mark Bolan, you know, so we were just lumped in with glam, you know, that was it.
Well, you had started out in producing in the early 70s, didn't you?
Working for Feldman's Publishing, I was on the lookout for bands and things, you know, for them, for publishing. I'd go to all the clubs. First people I brought into the office was Linda Thompson. She was in a duo called Paul and Linda. I saw her in a club, and we had the Bob Dylan Basement tapes, and Albert Grossman had been over and said, can we get some covers on these, you think? What do you think? You know, we were like, sure. So I brought them in. I took them up to Ian Ralphini at MGM Records up the road in Dean Street in Soho. And they auditioned for him, and he signed them for two singles. And so that was Linda Thompson's first outing, you know, Richard and Linda Thompson. So then there were other bands that I got involved with. And Nick Simper left Deep Purple. He made a few demos, and I said, leave them with me and I'll take them up to Mike Everett, who signed Duke to RCA later. But I took them up to Mike Everett, who was at Philips at the time for Vertigo, a Vertigo label. And he said, yeah, I love it. You know, and so he signed Warhorse, which was Nick Simper's new band. So I produced, kind of co-produced both of those albums for Mike Everett. And so it went. It went on and on from there, little bits and pieces. Mud, you know, Mud were managed by Ronnie Beck, and then Mickey Most stormed in the office one day and said, I want this band. We've got to work this out. You know, he was very aggressive. And the band all had a meeting, you know, with Ronnie, and then we all were around the pub, and the band said to me, what do you think? And I said, you know, they were just, you know, I'd produced one single with them, Shangri-La on Philips, and I said, listen, guys, you know, it's Mickey Most, and you know, you'll be on top of the Pops in a few weeks, you know. And they were like, yeah. And they were very loyal to Ronnie, you know, but we all were. But they said to Ronnie, we're going to do this, Ronnie. And Ronnie said, okay. So they signed with Mickey Most and Tim Chapman, of course. You know, that was it. I mean, that was it. So that was another thing I did at film. Anyway, moving on.
So Mud were another band who started out as one kind of thing, but ended up pivoting into the glam rock thing later?
Yeah, they were kind of a capable band, you know, harmony-wise and music-wise, they were capable, but they were not going to go anywhere, you know. Mickey Most had seen them at a club in London. Mike Chapman and Mickey Most saw them in a club, and Mike Chapman said, let's get them, you know. And that was, they dressed them up, you know. They joined the glam set, I guess you'd say, but it was more like an Elvis Presley takeoff for Les Gray, you know. They were all very good anyway. And with Mike Chapman's songs behind them in production, it was off and running, you know.
Yeah, I guess a lot of the time to be successful in the glam thing, it had to be kind of teeny bopper, right? And that's the thing. Juke never was. I guess Bish Bash Bosh that was kind of an attempt, but just the sound of your records and the look of the band, you never were teeny bopper at all. You were a rock band, like you said. So
right, and we rocked out on stage, extended solos, and I used to dive around on my knees and everything. You know, we played with Wizard and people like that, and they liked us. They were like, you're a good little band. And they're like, yeah, you know, we were just rocking and rolling, you know. When I wrote Bish Bash Bosh, as I said, you know, I took it to the rehearsals and I said, let's try this because, you know, it's a matter of survival, guys, lads, you know. And so we worked it up and I could tell they were unhappy, you know. Trevor was like, oh, man, you know. And I said, well, you know, we've got to try something. So we went in to the studio and recorded it, you know, and they loved it. They were like, yeah, you know, this is what's happening. So that's the road we started on. If we had gotten the tour and we'd gotten on Top of the Pops and, you know, things started happening, it would have been a question of churning out, you know, Trent Chapman songs at that point.
Yeah. So the band starts with just you and Trevor White, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So how did you and Trevor White meet? When did you first meet Trevor?
He was another musician known to John Hewlett. He'd just subbed in John's Children a few times, as had the drummer Chris Townsend was in John's Children with John Hewlett. You know, they were all connected. And John introduced me to Trevor. He said, "I got a friend that's a really good guitar player. He's great with, you know, he's a Beach Boys fan. He's very good with all of that, and harmonies and guitar playing, and he was in a band with his brother, the AJs." And I said, "Oh, well, let's meet." You know, so we started meeting in a pub, you know, in Trevor's lunch breaks. He was a ticket office, some kind of, you know, theater ticket office, and I was in Feldman's, you know. So we just decided to do it. You know, I went home one day and I said, "Helen, I'm leaving Feldman's. I'm going to start a band." My wife, you know, and she looked at me and she said, it was like, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, it's going to get paid for. You know, John Hill is going to get the money. So I'm having a break, you know, because my boss Ben Nisbet at Feldman's was leaving the company to start his own company, a record company, Big Ben Music, you know. And I'd had enough of all of it at that point, you know. I'd met Albert Grossman at that point, which was good, you know. So after Duke folded, I looked him up again when he came to London, and we never parted after that. We bonded properly, and we had bonded before, you know, at Feldman's. I was on loan to him when he came over to go shopping with him, you know, antiques and all that kind of stuff. So he asked me to work for him then. I said, "No, I'm going to start a band. I got a recording deal." And I left Feldman's. And then when that all folded, I met Albert again, and he said, "Work for me." And I said, "Okay." So that was that, you know. That brought me here. You know, so Feldman's, Trevor went on to do the Island thing. Chris remained in blues bands. Chris was a great graphic artist, too. He did, greetings cards and things and humorous things. He was really good. So he had that going for himself and playing in blues bands. And Ian Hampton did a lot of sessions. He was, he was in demand a little bit for sessions, you know, and then he got a job as some computer tech, you know, eventually, and settled in that. And but he made enough money to invest with his lady Jan, and they bought a little hotel in Brecon, Wales, and so he became a hotelier for years. And then he met people, Alvin Stardust, people like that came through. It's a tourist town. And so, and then he got very friendly with Joe Elliott. He's a big buddy of Joe Elliott's, and who narrates the Duke documentary, actually. After that, he sold the hotel and retired. So that was that. And then Chris died. You know, the drummer died. I was here, they were there, and so that was the passing of Chris. So when we did the reunion, we had Simon Stewart on drums, and Simon was a 20-year-old fantastic young drummer who was doing sessions in London, and the guys had met him, and they said, "Can we bring Simon Stewart on drums?" I said, "Sure, let's do it," and it worked out beautifully, you know. So that was that.
So going back to Feldman's, when you say you were working in publishing, right, so does that mean that you were looking for songwriters?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you want to sign them to publishing deals?
Correct.
It's different from being an A&R. You're not trying to get them, or are you also trying to get them a record deal?
With Nick Simper's band Warhorse, I got them the record deal at Vertigo Phillips with Mike Everett and produced the record. Mudd asked me to work with them on their single. They'd gotten a single deal with Phillips, I believe it was Phillips. And they said, everybody said, yeah, do it with Mudd, help Mudd. And I said, okay. So we recorded Johnny Arkey was the arranger in Phillips' studio, actually. And so I was present. I was really the producer in name. I mean, I was at the control desk and they were recording, and I was adding my tuppence, We had worked the song up together, so that's how the Mudd thing happened,
So you wanted to be in a band yourself. Was working at Feldman's just your way to be a part of the industry and to try to find your way into the music business yourself, or?
Yeah, I left Edinburgh. I was a trainee draftsman in Edinburgh, and I met a friend who had been at school with, and he was living in London, in an apartment in London. He said, come down if you want to see what you can do down there. And my wife, Helen, had met a Liverpool musician. Her father had hotel at that point in Jedburgh, and they had a band stay with them. In fact, Mudd used to stay with them afterwards. Before they were famous, they always checked in at Jedburgh and Helen's dad's hotel and did a gig there, and we were all very close. But anyway, this Liverpool musician was staying there, and Helen talked to him about me. I was in bands in Edinburgh, and so he said, tell him to come down and check us out. So, and then I met Brian in the street in Edinburgh, and he was going back to his apartment in London. He said, come down. So I said to my mum and dad, I'm going to go down to London and check it all out. And they were like, what? And I said, yeah. So I went down there and decided that it was for me. And I got a job. One of the big stores in London is Selfridges in Oxford Street. And I got a temp job there over Christmas to get settled. And I was allowed to stay at the apartment, Brian's apartment. And I wrote letters. I got a job in the music department, which was really good for me. And there was an old lady there who was running the music department. She was really great, and she had contacts in the music business. So she told me what to do, She said, well, you want to write letters and give a little bit of your history and, see if they've got any jobs for you. And so I did. And it landed on Ben Nisbet's desk at Feldman's. Called me, and I went in to see him. Funny, because I had an old tweed suit that I'd taken down there, and it was falling apart. So the night before the interview, I ironed plastic tape on the inside of the pants because they were ripping. It was a suit, but it was falling apart. Wow. I went in there very uncomfortable, and I sat with Ben Nisbet, who was the managing director, and he said to me, so your letter's interesting, so tell me about yourself. And I said, yeah. And he said, what kind of music do you like, young man? And I said, well, everything from, I looked around the room in the office, and I said, everything from Bob Dylan to Beethoven, I guess. And he looked at me and he said, did somebody tell you to say that? And I said, say that? I said, no, that's just off the top of my head, He said, well, that's interesting, because we published Bob Dylan, and we have Breitkopf and Hartel in the business, which is the Beethoven publisher. And I said, wow, and he said, you're sure nobody? I said, absolutely not. I'm telling you the truth. That's what I am, too. So he offered me the job of starting in the trade department, which I did with any new person, for 3 months, for less money than I was making at Selfridges. I was starving at Selfridges. And so I worked my way up from the trade department and the professional department. And the main job was plugging, going around the radio stations and getting airplay for records,
Okay.
And so that was my main job. My other job was scouting for, bands and writers. And so I was there until I left for Duke,
Right. And so when John Hewlett introduces you to Trevor, he's hoping you guys are going to start a band that he can work with?
Yeah, that was his intention.
Yeah.
Put these two together, they're both of the same mind, they can start a band, and we did.
And you were the main, you were the songwriter in Juke, right? It seems like you wrote all or most of the songs.
Yep, I did. I did. Trevor came up with two or three great songs, but he was not prolific. And we never had writing sessions. You know, I was in the north of London. The other guys were in the... Well, Trevor was in the south of London, so he'd come up every day to rehearse. We met in a rugby club barn at the... There was never, interestingly enough, never an intent to get together to write. And so I ended up, you know, going back from rehearsals with riffs in my mind and progressions. And I sat till the early hours of the morning most days and worked out some songs, you know. And that was it. And I took them to the rehearsals and we worked them out. And the other guys, Ian and Chris, didn't have any writing aspirations, chops or anything. But Trevor came up with, you know, over the 2 years, he came up with like three really good songs. It's just, I've written one kind of thing. And we were like, okay, and they were good. Yeah.
So when you started the band, when you first started, had the glam thing really taken off yet? Or was it, did it kind of coincide with when you start the band, all of a sudden glam just takes over?
Right, well, we were signed to RCA by Mike Everett, and he had just signed Bowie, and Bowie was starting to roll. So by the time we started recording, coming back from Scotland to London and forming the band proper and recording, Bowie was rolling. You know, he'd gotten a few records away, Gene Sheeny, things like that, and so the whole glam thing kicked in just as we got the band rolling, really. That's what happened. And it was a glam world at that point. Everything had to be glam, you know. And we were really not interested, but that's what happened, you know. And we got lumped into the glam thing because of the way we looked and the girly magazines and all that kind of thing, you know. We just became part of that scene, you know. But we never joined the glam scene, you know. We just kept doing what we were doing, you know.
Well, the songs that you were writing, like King Cap and Ooh Ooh Rudy, they do fit with glam, but they are different because they're more riffy and they're just heavier and just cooler rock songs. And right. And not at all teeny bopper. They don't sound like a Chin and Chapman song at all. They do seem like they also would have worked before or after glam, but they also do fit. Like, it also does work within the glam scene as well. So that's
yeah.
So you weren't writing those songs like King Cap and Ooh Ooh Rudy. Were those just naturally the songs you wrote, or were you thinking about trying to have a hit?
Was a play on the Jamaican Rudy thing. That just came into my mind. And, you know, The Harder They Come was out at that time and everything. We were enamored of the movie. And Rudy, I love the Rudy thing, you know, so I wrote that for that, really.
Come on the streets with the Jew. Take a look around. Everybody's living in the past. If they knew, if only they knew what we're all about, yeah, maybe then they'd understand why that way just won't last. Ooh, Rudy, you know I'm right. Sometimes it's rough for the most.
Pantheon Podcast listeners, Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
King Cat was, I'd always been an Andy Cat fan, cartoons, and he was a household cartoon in the UK, and I was sitting fiddling one night, and King Cat, I thought that's kind of cool, so I incorporated some of the band members into the into the song, at the bar with Chalky White, which was, I think it was made, but it worked with Trevor White, and when I was in a band in Edinburgh, there was two singers in one band I was in, and me being one of them. And the guy was much older than us. We were all teens. He was an older guy, known in Edinburgh, And he used to go down to the Dole office, the unemployment office, and he was making plenty of money singing and working. And he always had this joke that he signed his weekly unemployment check with a gold rolled pencil, which always tickled me, And he was a character.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got that in the song too, it's gold rolled pencil, something like that. And Trevor White said Chalky White. And anyway, that was it. I just sat around in my home and conjured up King Cap, for Andy Cap. produced that record for us. He was one of, I think, Brian Ferry's main man at that time. John Hewlett had met and known Brian Ferry with, because Sparks were on island, you know, so were Ferry, and he got to know John Porter, and John liked the band and produced the record and played piano on it, actually.
Yeah, King Cap is a great record. I love the sound. The production is great, and the riffs. It's a pretty heavy. It's a heavy rock song, and but it's also fun and catchy. So the songs that ended up being released after the band broke up, La La Girl and Aggravation Place, were those? So how close were you to actually recording a full length album for Juke?
Well, that was the idea. You know, we were working towards that. And all those tracks, you know, the non-release tracks were all recorded at R.G. Jones Studio in Wimbledon, right next door to the Wimbledon Tennis Stadium. And so they were all, we produced ourselves on a lot of those tracks, you know. So, they were all headed for, when we got the go-ahead to make an album, which would have happened, I think, after Bispash Bosch, those were intended for that. But you know, as I said, you know, with the advent of Bispash Bosch, we were really, you know, had it happened, we were committing to joining the fray. I don't know if the A&R people, RCA, they just wanted to, you know, a bunch of Bispash Bosches, I think, you know.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah. In that time period, it's weird how short something like the glam thing actually is, if you look back on it, that it really only lasted a few years. But at the time, it probably seemed like, well, this is how it's going to be now, you know. But of course, everything changes pretty quick. You know, punk happens in 76, 77, and then nobody cares about glam anymore.
Right. It was never my favorite, you know, thing anyway. I mean, I'm sure there's a few that I really like, but, you know, I didn't like most of what was happening. You know, you turn on Top of the Pops, it was half an hour of silly bands, you know, really. All, you know, parading themselves and makeup and sparkly clothes and high-heeled boots and silly songs. You know, it was never really, I never really got close to that, you know. So, I don't know, you know. I was still going for Robert Palmer and people like that at that point, you know, like people like Jug, you know.
Yeah, well, if you look at pictures of Juke, you look more like a punk band or a mod band, if you want to go back to the earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it was that. People also called us a skinhead band. We were never a skinhead band, you know, but they were Juke the skinhead band. We were like, what? You know?
Well, I guess if you were a glam band that had short hair, that's just what, if you didn't have longer hair. Because Slade cut their hair early on, and they had the same issue where they were supposedly a skin.
The thing I remember about Slade that always amused me, I think we just found them amusing, you know. But they used to add their stomping boots to the records, you know, in the hallway of the studios. You know, the last thing they'd put on would be the toop, 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 toop. And it was all very... it was a formula, you know. But he just Noddy just kept cranking out those choruses, you know, and that was it, you know.
I guess basically Juke's entire career, you rolled the dice on Bish Bash Bosh, and if that had been a hit, then you would have had a record. But since it wasn't a hit, and since the Sweet Tour didn't happen, the band just split up, basically?
Yeah, it broke up. I got a job, and then the guys were offered the Sparks gig, and they called me and said, you know, what do you think? Should we do this? You know, we think we should do it. Do you think? I said, just go for it. Go for it, man. You need to work. You know, you need... And he had a couple of years of touring the world, you know, with Sparks. You know, Sparks were huge in Europe as well as Britain. He had like top ten singles in Britain, I think, in the UK. And they were big in Sweden and Germany, and then they tried to break in the US, so they spent a lot of time over here, you know, gigging, and but it didn't happen. But you know, yeah, so Trevor and he had a whale of a time for a couple of years, you know, touring the world, you know.
So the band really only existed for about 3 years.
Yeah.
Did you play a lot of shows? Like what were the places where you would play, and what kind of bands would you share the bill with?
Oh, we played all over the place. We played with Brinsley Schwartz, Wizard, Ian and the Zodiacs, I think it was one of them.
Brinsley Schwartz, that's interesting. So yeah, so the pub rock, there was the whole pub rock thing happening at the same time.
Right, exactly. We fell between the cracks there, because there was a raw pub rock thing happening, and we were not part of that either. You know, we should have been. We were on the fringes of it, but we never became a pub rock band. You know, we played clubs and universities, and we played with Peter Gabriel. We played with Genesis. It was a funny one. It was in a university in the Midlands somewhere, and when we got together for the reunion, the guys were chatting away about, you know, the old days, and they said, "Remember that gig we did with Genesis?" And I had not remembered. I was like, "No, I don't remember that." And they went, "Oh, come on, you must." And I said, "I don't." And they said, "Well, Trevor was always very amusing, very funny. He's a very funny lad. He's got, you know, he kept us all laughing." He said, "Oh yeah, we were in tears at that gig watching them performing." And I said, "We were." And he said, "Yeah, they came out dressed as trees, you know, with costumes with, you know, they were trees, you know." And I was like, "Oh, I do have a vague recollection of that, you know." And we were all laughing. And later on, I checked it out. I saw a photograph of Gabriel doing it. And I was like, "Oh my God, yeah, I remember now." But I mean, it was so, you know, we got out and rocked and rolled at the university, and they came on and they were all dressed as trees. You know, it was just, a bizarre time, you know, really.
Yeah. I hadn't ever thought of that before, but Juke really were kind of in between pub rock and glam rock, and must have been weird. Right. Yeah, it must have been a strange time when both of those things were happening at the same time, and here you were.
I think the pub rock thing was only getting rolling too, and the punk and pub rock thing got rolling slightly after us, you know. Dr. Feelgood, one of my favorite bands, they were not really happening when we were, it was slightly after, you know, so, you know, our music preceded some of that, some of the main thrust of those things, you know, that was it. And we did a gig with Jack Bruce at a university, and our host, was a student body, you know, took us. He come with me, and he took us down a corridor to, "This will be your dressing room," you know. And so he knocked on the door. We were all standing there with our stage clothes over our shoulders and everything, you know. And he knocked on the door, and the door opened. It was Jack Bruce, who was Scottish, you know, too, you know. I mean, there's two Englishmen in our band and two Scotsmen, he and me. And anyway, the door opened, and Jack Bruce looked out, and he went, "Yeah?" And the guy said, "This is your support band, so I have to get them in so they can get changed." And he said, he looked at us and he said, "I don't give an F who they are." And he used the word, "I don't give an F who they are. They're not effing coming in here." And we were like, "Oh, okay." And he just closed the door. So he said, "Oh, I'm sorry about this." And we were like, "Whatever. I guess he wants his privacy." And he went, yeah, "Well, come with me. We'll find you somewhere." So he put us in the biology lab. "So just be okay, this bench is here, and you can..." And we said, sure, it's okay. And there was a python, a baby python, in a glass cage. And I said, "Oh, he's beautiful." And he said to me, you want to hold him?" And I said, "Yeah, really?" I said, "Sure." So he brought him out, and I had him around me and holding him, you know. And it was great, you know. And it was the first time I'd held a snake, and it was just leathery, you know, just leathery. And anyway, I mention that because it stays with me. It was a lovely moment, you know, back. And anyway, Jack Bruce told us to piss off, basically, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never forgot that either. I was, you know, jerk, you know. He wasn't pleasant, you know. He couldn't have said, listen, guys, I really want my privacy or something. He just said, you know, he was swearing, you know.
That's funny because isn't Ginger Baker the one from that band that's more famous for being an asshole? But it sounds like...
I think both of them were.
Yeah.
I think Clapton had enough. After he left Cream, he said, I'll never record aggressive music again. That's what he said to some interview meeting. I think it was just a reflection of what the band was like, you know, the two guys in the band.
So did you play many shows with other glam bands, or?
No, we weren't in that circuit at all. No, we never, I don't ever remember, except for Wizard. We did a gig with Wizard somewhere in Birmingham or somewhere, and they were all decked out, you know, Roy Wood. And but they were good. They were a rocking band. They were all decked out glam, but it was Roy Wood was just something else. You know, he was glam, but he wasn't, you know.
Yeah,
you know.
And he had been in a big band before, and he had already racked up a bunch of hits. So,
right,
yeah. But it's interesting that he went with it. Like, I guess, you know, in that era, you had to make a choice: are you gonna throw in with glam or not? Right.
Right. Well, he was. I think Roy Wood was. He made good records, but, you know, he had that Phil Spector sound, but it was slightly embarrassing. He was an older guy, and he had stars all over his face, you know, and makeup on his eyes and his hair, and it was like, oh, dear God, you know. But anyway, I mean, having known who he was before, he jumped right in the glam thing, you know.
It's funny to hear you talk like that because, you know, in America, we had the same thing in the 80s with the what they call hair metal. And there were certain bands that were, they sounded pretty close to the same, but, well, if you have a band like Guns N' Roses, so they're never going to look like Poison, but they're at the same time and they're all kind of getting lumped together. And, yeah, it's interesting. I never really thought about that, but so were there quite a few bands at the time that were resistant to the glam thing? Was there that kind of,
No, not that I know of. Only we broached the subject of pub rock, and I think there was that element happening there. You know, Heel Pie Island and the pubs around London, and we were too busy doing what we were doing to even take notice of that. But it was pot boiling at that point. You know, that was the slightly older musicians too. You know, but that was what was happening away from. Glam, you know.
What would it have taken for Bish Bash Bosh to get you guys on Top of the Pops? Did it already have to at least be a minor hit? Or did Top of the Pops turn things into hits? Or did you already have to...
Right. You would have had the RCA promotion guys. We were on tour. We would have been on tour with Sweet. And we'd been doing the rounds. And we were really good live. So we'd probably, you know, been helping ourselves there as the Sweet support act, and the RCA promotion people would have been pounding Top of the Pops, you know, with Bish Bash Bosh, and that's what happened. That's how you got on, you know, and we're very hopeful that they would score, you know, so we would have probably ended up doing a spot on Top of the Pops, and that's all you really needed, you know. It was reaching millions of people around the country, you know.
So you think, basically, if the Sweet tour had happened, you probably would have been on Top of the Pops?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all agree that would have happened, you know.
And, that song would have fit perfectly at the time on Top of the Pops. It almost seemed like it was a Chin and Chapman song or whatever, even though you wrote it.
I don't think the guys ever looked at it as a Chin Chapman song, but I certainly modeled it on what they were doing. You know, I I did. You know, I sat and thought, well, you know, this is how they, into the hooks and the, you know, and also the, you know, the spoken thing, you know, where it says, my, you
right.
know, and that was all taken from that, you know. So it was a deliberate effort to write a pop song for survival with RCA, you know, and that's what I did.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so when you're writing Bish Bash Bosh, you're like, either I'm going to have to go get a job or I'm going to write this song. Was that kind of...
Right, yeah, exactly. We were running out of time with our recording contract and with our patience, you know. They were like, well, you're a good little band, but there's not much, we're not able to take this anywhere. Yeah, it was reaching that point. And I said to the guys when, you know, I auditioned the song, I said to them, you know, this is about survival, guys. We got to, you know, appease the A&R people. We've got to try to, let's just do this and see what they think, you know? And they were like, okay, you know.
So you said Brian Connolly got the crap beaten out of him in a pub.
Yeah.
So basically, do you know what happened? Why? How the fight started?
I heard he was playing pool or something, and it was the same old thing, you know, the dyed blonde hair and the clothing and everything else, and a bunch of you know, Torax, a bunch of boot boys just took it out on him, you know, like, you know, you're a fucking poofter or whatever, excuse me, but something like that, you know, and he got beaten up, you know. I mean, he's probably capable of looking after himself, but they beat him up, you know, and we got the call, you know, Brian's in hospital. We were like, what? You know, and it was awful, just awful, you know. But I mean, that was the backlash too about, you know, glam, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, working guys, you know, drinking their beer and seeing a guy like him playing pool and all his finery and his blonde dyed hair and everything, they were, you know, they just decided to take it out on him, I guess. Horrible, but that's how it went. It happened to Forkat here in America, who I worked with on Bearsville Records, you know, and you know, they were touring in the South, and they were doing as much the same thing. They were in a bar, I think, playing pool again or something like that. And the local guys and the local town guys, you know, started deriding them and calling them fairies and all, whatever they were calling them. And they got into a punch-up, you know. And the bass player at the time had all his teeth smashed and everything. They had to cancel gigs and a replacement bass. He was beaten up badly, and that happened to them. You know, it was the long hair and the clothing, and you know, it was a bad moment for Foghat, but they survived it. You know?
Wow. Yeah. So I'm just thinking, if only Brian Connolly hadn't gotten beaten up, we would probably have a juke record, right? A full length album, right?
Right. Well, Joe Elliott talks on the Duke documentary. He talks about us and the Times and Glam and Sparks and everything else. And he calls Bish Bash Boss. He says it's a classic. You know, he said it's one that got away. You know, unheralded or something like that. Classic. You know, so he was way into. He was a kid at the time. You know,
yeah.
Sparks. This town ain't big enough for the both of us. And he loved Bish Bash Bosh, you know, and that's where it was at, you know. He's in the playground, he's talking about listening to music with kids and the kids in the play, talking about music in the playground and stuff. Yeah, so that's it. It would have been a change. I don't know if the band would have survived anyway after a while. Probably. But, it definitely wasn't, you know, who we were. It was because we did it, but it was contrived, you know. And Ian Hampton, the bass player, said to me years ago, a long time ago now, he said, you know, you'd be surprised, man. He said, he says, one of the records you hear in the dance clubs all the time. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, they love it in the dance clubs, you know. So I was like, okay, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I like it, but I like King Cap and Ooh Ooh Rudy and La La Girls. I like those songs a lot more than Bish Bash Bosh, but you did do a great job of writing that kind of song and, you know, trying to make it happen. And I definitely could see where you were coming from at the time.
Yeah.
So how did you end up having that record released on Bomp Records? Did you have interaction with Greg Shaw? Or how did that come about?
They approached us about putting it out. And, you know, we have all the demos that you mentioned and everything. They're on Saw Song Music. I have that. We have that, you know. But all the RCA releases have to be licensed, you know. And they asked us if we were into it. And I said, sure. And in fact, while we're talking about it, Cherry Red Records have put out a three-CD compilation. They've used Aggravation Place. And we said, sure. And I just got an email last week from John Reed again, asking if they can do Bish Bash Bosh in another compilation. And I said to him, sure, but this one's an RCA, is RCA product. You know, because the Aggravation Place, I was able to give him permission, but, you know, he has to license Bish Bash Bosh, you know.
Right.
So that's what's happened. Those companies, if they you know, want to use those records, they have to license them.
When did Different Class come out? Like 2004? I guess they licensed everything because they've got everything on here. Yeah, and so this CD has songs like Different Class and Cooch on it. When were those songs recorded? Were those recorded like
they
at this?
Recorded at R.G. Jones over the maybe after. Yeah, they were just recorded in the 2 years. We'd go into R.G. Jones and just record new stuff, you know, as we were in town or whatever, you know, set aside recording session time, you know.
Yeah, you basically had a whole album if it had been put together. Yeah.
Definitely.
Jammed up tight to a La La Girl. I want to smooch you back to the big bell scent with a La La Girl. Belly to belly and cheek to cheek in the warm night air. We get way out past the pressure, lost without a care. With a La La Girl to hold me, I feel good.
Another thing I should draw your attention to, I don't know if you know Steve Wright, he's an author and puts out rock books, and he put out two books on Duke recently, in the last couple of years. One was Nobody's Fools, The Ultimate Guide to Duke, Steve Wright, and then he followed it up with Crazy Kids, Life After Duke,
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
They're good. They're worth recommending. They're good, you know. I was really pleasantly surprised. So he's become a you know, an acquaintance, you know.
Did you continue writing songs all this time? Do you still write?
I wrote a few things with my friend John Holbrook. In fact, we recorded two tracks after the Hartford show that are really good. I mean, they're really good. They're two of the best things we ever did. And I co-wrote those with John Holbrook, who I'd produced Randy Van Warmer records with and other things. And we got together. He lived up the road here a piece. And so we wrote and worked together a little bit. We wrote three songs. We wrote one for Brian Setzer. He was engineering Brian Setzer. And Brian Setzer's second album after Vavoom wasn't happening. And I mean, John said there's not a single on the whole thing. And I said, well, let's write one. I said to him, think of a good, you know, think of a Brian Setzer, you know, vibe, rhythm and stuff. And they came up with this drum bass thing. And I said, that's good. And so I wrote a song with him called Vavoom, you know, which was based on it. And sent it out to Brian Setzer. And he said to John, he said, you're a genius, man. He said, how did this happen? And John said, well, I just wanted to offer it because I think you need a single, you know. And so he took it to Geffen Records, and they said, no. We're up to 300,000 at the moment. We're way over budget. We're not going to do any more recording. We don't want any more of your suggestions, Brian. They said, here's two songs we think you should do, and if, you know, that's it. We either do this or don't, and we'll put the album out as is. So he went in and he did two songs that was recommended by the record company. They were, you know, the usual, you know, boring, you know. And so it never got released, you know, but it was really, again, it was a bish-bash bosh, if I say myself, you know, but it never saw the light of day, you know.
Wow. Do you still have that recording? Do you have it digital?
Sure.
Would you want me to play that on the show, or even just a clip of it? Would that be all right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Punching in and punching out. Those working hours drag by. I daydream about twilight time, me and Sweetie Pie. Whoa, my baby, you know I drive right. Whoa, I keep a motor purring every night. Yeah, away we go. You guys all know, ain't no doubt what she's all about. Makes you wanna shout.
Just howling sassy. man, I tell you, life can be beautiful. For sure, for sure. That's what I like. Va-va-voom, baby.
I think Aggravation Place stands out as there's really nothing glam rock about that. I mean, it doesn't even, that's not a glam rock song. That's just a, that's just a rock song. That's just a, it's kind of a timeless kind of song.
I think it's my, I definitely think it's my best song.
Alright, I hope you enjoyed that conversation I had with Ian Kimmett from the band Juke. Earlier in the episode, we heard an unreleased song called Vavoom that Ian co-wrote to potentially be included on a Brian Setzer album. Didn't end up being used, but it was great to get to hear it on the podcast. And now I'm going to leave you with another previously unreleased song that Ian sent me. He wrote that, "We recorded these out of a desire to mark the 40th reunion concert, recorded here locally over the Hudson River in Paul Antonell's Clubhouse Studio in Rhinebeck." That's in New York. So this song we're going to hear play was co-written by Ian Kimmett and John Holbrook, who also produced the recordings. And I guess John Hewlett also contributed a basic idea, the basic idea for this song. And the song is performed by the three surviving members of Juke, Ian Kimmett, Ian Hampton, and Trevor White. So check it out. This is a previously unreleased reunion song from Juke called Play.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.